This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. As we say so long to 2011, we'll analyze the year's top stories with our bureau chiefs in Sacramento, Fresno, and Los Angeles. And the end of the Iraq War means military families are reunited and adjusting to a new normal.
I did my best this time around to not jump back in and try to change rules and change the family direction because they already have a system in place.
Also, an unemployed screenwriter describes his year looking for work.
I became deeply obsessed with daily reruns of The Munsters, which was psychotic. How could Marilyn not understand she was beautiful? And what happened to her parents? Did Grandpa use them for spare parts to make Herman?
And Under the Radar, our rock and jazz critics pick the year's best music you might have missed. It's the California Report. Well, it is our final show for 2011, a year that began with the inauguration of a new governor and ended with the return of the last remaining troops from Iraq. In between, economic despair continued for many Americans, sparking protest by others.
We want jobs!
O-B-S-E-J-O-B-S!
We want jobs! We want jobs! We want jobs!
O-B-S-E-J-O-B-S!
My hours got cut at work, and I couldn't afford the insurance on my own, so I no longer have insurance.
We want just to cut everywhere. Cut our retirement, cut our education benefits, cut our health benefits.
S.O.S. Save our schools! S.O.S.
Ultimately, it may mean fewer students with fewer faculty and fewer instructors and lecturers, just a general downsizing. I hate it.
The economy that 1% have created, which is joblessness here and people working for pennies in other countries, and we want to rebuild the economy on a different basis.
And as 2011 slips into history, I'm joined by three of my colleagues who reported many of the stories you heard on the California Report over the past 12 months, our bureau chiefs, Chrissy Clark in Los Angeles, Sasha Coca in Fresno, and John Myers in Sacramento. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, I think it's certainly fair to say that 2011 was the economy, the year of the economy. It was the backdrop for more or less everything we reported this year, or a whole lot of it anyway. Sluggish recovery, stubbornly high unemployment rate statewide. And Sasha, let me begin with you. In Fresno, agriculture, of course, is the backbone of the Central Valley's economy. How has it fared this year?
Well, Scott, it's been one bright spot in the state's economy, I would say. A record year for crops like cotton and pistachios. Exports of California farm products were up. Farmers had a good water supply after struggling with several years of drought. But all that doesn't necessarily trickle down, and this year Fresno became the poorest county in the state. In fact, a new report from the Brookings Institution says Fresno is lagging behind most American cities when it comes to recovery from the recession. So the question is, how do you diversify that farm economy? Is it green jobs? Is it manufacturing? And part of that depends on retraining people, and community colleges and social services have been hit hard by budget cuts this year. One economic driver that's still championed by some city and county leaders here as a job engine is the high-speed rail, which is supposed to break ground here next year. But political opposition could stop that project in its tracks.
Chrissy Clark in Los Angeles, in the past, when California has lifted itself out of economic recession, often it's been Southern California that's done the lifting. You know, a lot of the jobs created down there with the ports and the entertainment industry and so on. This time around, it's my impression that L.A. is not exactly leading the way in terms of job creation. What's your sense of how L.A.'s economy is doing as we finish up the year?
What's interesting is how mixed things are across this region. We're kind of a microcosm of the state, a mashup of inland and coastal economic trends. So in Los Angeles County, we have trade, which you mentioned, and that's actually doing pretty well right now. The ports of LA and Long Beach, the first and second busiest ports in the country, are expected to have their best years ever in terms of exports, largely due to the growing economies in developing countries in like India and China. Tourism and leisure industries have been picking up lately, and we have Hollywood and the knowledge economy industries that have been a bit more sort of recession-proof. But we still do have almost 12% unemployment. LA County has one of the highest numbers of uninsured people in the state and in the country. And then further inland, you have a very different picture and a worse picture. In San Bernardino and Riverside counties, the economy has really relied on construction and the real estate boom, and we know how those things have been going in the last few years. And the Inland Empire leads the nation in terms of foreclosures, and there's expected to be another wave of those coming. So things are still kind of tough down here.
One of the big stories, of course, this year was the Occupy Wall Street movement, and a lot of the attention focused on the coasts in Los Angeles, here in San Francisco, and across the bay in Oakland, a little bit up in UC, Davis, just south of where you are, John. And I want to ask you about that, John Myers. Governor Brown has been relatively quiet, almost silent this whole year on the Occupy Wall Street movement. What is your sense of where he's at on that and the economy? And it's obviously cast a big pall over his budget and his governing in the first year in office.
You know, on the Occupy thing, Scott, I mean, I think Brown, Jerry Brown, is often thought of as this provocative, outspoken thinker. But I think if you look back at his past, that's usually when he was not in office. As a state official, and I think as governor, Brown's been pretty quiet, but quiet on things that he thought probably were either unrelated or tangential to the state budget crisis. That's really where he spent all of his time. I think it is fair, too, that there's probably an element of the governor being wary of any unnecessary pokes in the eye of the business community who he's been courting all year on the issue of taxes. On the economy, I think there's really some hope inside the state capitol. We've heard, obviously, in Fresno and L.A. that things are still tough. I mean, if you look overall, California added about a net of 233,000 jobs over the year, but that growth has been very slow in areas. And I think that means, you know, deep cuts in government services to schools and health and welfare. And those cuts are only going to get deeper, I think, in 2012.
And John, the big message of the Occupy movement is the 99% versus the 1%, that income disparity. And there have been reports just in the past few weeks that California has one of the largest income disparities among the 50 states. I think we rank in one study somewhere between Alabama and Texas. John, how do you see that message playing out in 2012, you know, the haves versus the have-nots?
I think the easy way, Scott, that we'll see it is in the issue of taxes. We're going to end this year with four or five competing proposals for the November 2012 ballot to raise taxes. You've got progressive Democrats who want an income tax solely on the most wealthy. Governor has a more pragmatic approach of an income tax hike for the wealthy plus higher sales taxes. You know, polling shows that the haves and have-nots debate is really salient in California right now. And I think in 2012, we're going to hear and see Jerry Brown a lot more in public, having to tell Californians that they've got to pick deeper cuts or new taxes. As he said earlier in December, he said there is no third way. And I think that is what you're going to hear Brown talk about a lot to the public. You got to pick in 2012.
That's John Myers in Sacramento. Thanks to you. Thanks also to Chrissy Clark in Los Angeles, Sasha Coca in Fresno. Happy New Year, you guys.
You too, Scott.
Happy New Year to you.
. 2011 marked the official end of the Iraq War, a conflict that left some 471 Californians dead and thousands more with physical and psychological wounds. For military families, the final troop withdrawal has meant joyous homecomings, like this one in Stockton, for members of the California Army National Guard. For these military families, it means 2012 will be a year of transition. We met up with two families this past week, including this one in Fremont, just north of San Jose.
My name is Keith Jackson, and we are sitting in our living room. My rank is sergeant, and I served as a clinic supervisor in Iraq.
After a 10-month deployment, Keith Jackson and his wife Amy are getting used to life together again. They're sitting side by side on a couch as their 20-month-old daughter, Lena, plays with her toys nearby.
Well, yeah, she was only a few months old when he first left, so I, you just sort of grit your teeth and bear it.
Amy and Keith were married nearly 4 years ago. She never really expected his National Guard unit would be called up, and then it was.
I ended up quitting my job before he left because I didn't want to put her in daycare. And so I decided to stay home with her.
During war, there are sacrifices all around. But many military families say that deployment is often hardest on the ones left behind.
What was the toughest part of his being gone?
Hearing that question, Amy Jackson's eyes fill with tears. She pauses 30 seconds or so, struggling to compose herself.
I'm not a single mom, but it feels like I'm a single mom. Having her 24/7 really, it's stressful. You have to be mom and dad.
I was always worried that when I come home, she may not know who I was. But because of things like Skype, she knew who Daddy was, you know. So that was great.
Even with Skype, it's still like maybe a half hour, and that's not living with somebody. We've never been in Iraq. He's been here. So there's an emptiness here, and I don't know if he felt that same thing there.
As Amy speaks, her husband holds one of Lena's toys in both hands. He's been home less than a month, returning to a family with different rules and routines than the one he left in February.
When I came back, I actually felt for a while that, I don't know, I felt like I'm not in charge of anything. Because over there I was a section sergeant. I was in charge of quite a few soldiers. I kind of ran the show, but here I was basically a private.
Jackson is beginning to reassert himself. He says one of his first priorities is to reduce what he now sees as clutter.
Coming home to America, you're just like, there is so much stuff here. There is stuff everywhere. There's people everywhere. There's stuff everywhere. There's too much stuff. You know, you look over here, Lena has a wall full of toys. And she could probably do with half of that and still be perfectly happy.
War changes those who fight and the ones who wait back home. The reunion is often an adjustment, a process of spouses and their children finding each other again.
It's sort of a roller coaster. I think we have like a good day and then a bad day. And he's also been working some odd shifts. He's been working in the middle of the night and then sometimes in the day. So coordinating, you know, what we're going to do with each other, especially during the holidays, it's been quite a balancing act, but...
It was very hectic.
Keith Jackson is now working as a part-time ER technician at Kaiser. His hope for 2012, getting accepted to school so he can get more medical training and eventually a better job.
You know, it's not exactly a comfortable financial situation. So we saved up a lot of money on this appointment, and so we're good for several months. But until I get that steady income, things are kind of, for me, a little scary.
Go and put him in the living room, buddy. Front room.
About 2 hours north, in Vacaville, Victor Ray and his family are also adjusting to his return home this month. He works full-time with the California National Guard and just completed his second tour of duty in Iraq. Sitting around the kitchen table, his wife, Amicel, describes the challenges of having a four-year-old son whose father is at war.
He'll have a bad morning and you just can't understand what's going on, and... After he settled down, he'll say it, you know, I want my daddy.
Michelle says she stopped watching the news. She just worried every time she heard about soldiers dying in Iraq. Their 16-year-old daughter, Soleil, had a different coping mechanism.
He comforted us with, like, the thought that, you know, he wasn't going to be out there actually fighting because all the fighting was pretty much done. So I took kind of a refuge in that thought that he was going to be okay. He wasn't going to be out there, you know, shooting and getting shot at.
The Rays learned a lot from Vic's first deployment. Amicel says she was much more relaxed this time, adding they learned how to balance everything and take help when it was offered. And Vic Ray learned that just because he was back home, it didn't mean he was in charge, at least not right away.
I did my best this time around to not jump back in and try to change rules and change the family direction because they already have a system in place.
Vic Ray says Iraq changed his priorities. Now, he says, he doesn't sweat the little stuff. Like Keith Jackson, he now feels more grateful. He's seen how little others have and still managed to be happy.
We're just being together as a family. It feels better. There's more meaning to it. It has nothing to do with what gift I give you.
As for 2012, Vic Ray wonders how all these returning veterans will be treated by the country they volunteered to serve.
I'm watching our politicians work, and I'm seeing the cuts and the threats, and that is a big concern of mine.
With the state's unemployment rate north of 11% all year, plenty of Californians spent 2011 tracking down leads for elusive jobs. TV writer and producer Gary Lucy shared those frustrations, but says he also found some joy in his time out of work.
I spent the better part of 2011 unemployed. Not the usual cyclical, rejuvenating kind of unemployment we Hollywood writer types are used to. I'm talking endless, hopeless, grinding joblessness, the kind the rest of the country is feeling. And it's really scary. March, April, and May seem like a lifetime ago now. That's when I had a cushy gig writing for a new network game show. 13 weeks of ka-ching. Back then, I was turning down other jobs. It seemed like the good times would never end. Until they did. Abruptly. June. I wait patiently by the phone for a new job to call. July. I get more active and actually send out a few resumes. August. Savings start to dwindle. Panic mounts. September. I start each day scouring the job boards in a frenzy and trying to seem casual as I reacquaint myself with old business contacts. Oh, me, nothing much. Just working on a new screenplay between assignments. But I'm not working on a screenplay. I never do when I'm unemployed. It's a superstitious thing. I don't want the universe to think I don't want a job. I want nature to see an employment vacuum and abhor me right into it. October. The job search officially seems futile. The score so far? 129 resumes sent, 2 interviews, 0 offers. Besides, after an hour of serious looking, you have nothing to do with the rest of your day except obsess about your predicament. That's when I got the idea for the perfect new job. Stop worrying about finding a new job. Instead, I would do stuff I love and hope the positive activity would attract the big fish. I didn't start a screenplay, but I did start a music podcast called Rock Solid, which is awesome. I became deeply obsessed with daily reruns of The Munsters, which was psychotic. How could Marilyn not understand she was beautiful? And what happened to her parents? Did Grandpa use them for spare parts to make Herman? I briefly reconsidered starting a screenplay, but instead start a blog about the Munsters. Then, in November, just to make sure I hit every cliche, I start a novel. And that's when unemployment really did become the better part of the year. For the first time in years, I'm actually enjoying writing every day. Now the stigma of unemployment seems like a gift, except around rent and meal times. But I'm happy. What's the plan for 2012? 2 things. Finish the novel and stay hopeful. That game show I worked on premieres this month. If it's a hit, maybe they'll make more. Please watch. And I hear there's a Munster reboot in the works. Maybe the creators will see my blog, Neckbolt City Limits, and hire me. Because obviously, I understand it deeply. To my fellow job searchers, I wish you luck and peace. Something's got to turn up. Feel free to use me as a reference. I'll be here at home, not working on a screenplay.
Comedy writer Gary Lucy co-hosts the podcast Never Not Funny presents Rock Solid. He lives in Southern California. Well, over the past 12 months, our pop music critic Steve Hockman and jazz reviewer Andrew Gilbert have highlighted some of their favorite albums from 2011. And as we get ready to ring in the new year, they're here to talk about some notable music that kind of flew under the radar this past year. Steve, Andy, welcome.
Great to be here with both of you.
Yeah, likewise.
All right. Well, guys, let's get to your under the radar list. And Steve Hockman, let's begin with you. And I think you're going to start with an artist named Hani El Khatib, who I understand is the son of a Palestinian and Filipino immigrants. Tell us about him.
Yeah, he was raised in San Francisco, and he's sort of, I'll describe him as the all-American garage rock boy, and that includes his cultural roots. I think of the White Stripes and the Black Keys as sort of antecedents to him, but he, like them, doesn't just take where they were, but he goes back to the roots, blues, rock, soul, doo-wop, and he's got this sort of like one-man show of this aggressive garage rock that's got a little punk in it. One of the titles that really struck out to me is a song that we want to play here. It's called Build, Destroy, Rebuild.
Yeah. Build and destroy.
That's Hani El Khatib from his debut album, Will the Guns Come Out? Well, Andy Gilbert, you're going to begin, I think, with a collection of various artists that was sort of lost in a vault for a while. Tell us about that.
This is the Music City Story. It's a 3-CD set that was painstakingly unearthed by Alec Palau, an El Cerrito-based producer. And Music City was an African-American-owned record label in Berkeley that really what became the source of black music in the East Bay. I mean, it's amazing who went through this label. Sly Stone, Larry Graham, John Fogerty, all those East Bay people who went on to be stars. I wanted to sort of end up with a late cut from this set. It's this just amazing kind of lost or cult soul singer, William Pullian, who recorded as Durando. This is a track of his called Didn't I?
Didn't I treat you right now? Didn't I do the best I could? Didn't I give you everything? Didn't I try my best just to be a man?
Steve Hockman, back to you. I think you're going to talk about a band from that hotbed of music innovation, Ventura County.
Yeah, you think about rock and roll, you think about Oxnard, right?
Totally.
This is the Sea Lions, and it's a young quintet. And this one really caught my attention. It's the main guy in it is named Adrian Pilato. He's been around for a few years. When I listen to him, it sounds to me like he spent his whole life listening to nothing but Buddy Holly, the Beach Boys, and the Cure. And his own version of this, it's heavily reverbed guitars, and the vocals are way back in the mix, so you can barely hear them. But it's got this real sweetness to it, and altogether it makes me think of Jonathan Richman. In fact, the song Grown Up really has that sort of Jonathan Richman quality, that enthusiasm, that I want to make music and I want to just sort of do it my own way kind of feel to it.
When I was young,
and again, that was the band Sea Lions from their album Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sea Lions But Were Afraid to Ask. Andy Gilbert, next up from you, I think, is Nicole Mitchell. Tell us about her.
She is a third-generation avant-garde flute player associated with Chicago's AACM, really influential movement. But she actually grew up in Anaheim, and now she has moved back to Southern California. She's teaching at UC Irvine, and her new album is just a beautiful, mostly straight-ahead session. And her music has tended to be really sort of ambitious, larger ensembles, these intricate suites, a lot of free improvisation. This is a different side of Nicole Mitchell, and it's wonderful to have her back in California because she's a major voice.
And this is from her new album called Awakening. And Steve Hockman, back to you now for your third pick on our Under the Radar songs and albums and artists from this year. And it's somebody who is called the King of Laurel Canyon. Tell us about him.
Jonathan Wilson. Now, he's starting to come up over the radar, I suppose. He came from North Carolina, and he did indeed settle in Laurel Canyon for a few years. He was taken under the wing of people like Jackson Browne and Graham Nash. But he's taken that vibe still, and his album Gentle Spirit will make you think of Crosby, Stills, Nash and or Young and Jackson and some of the other acts from that time. And it really had that spirit, gentle or otherwise, he really has brought that spirit to life.
Further out to sea, I heard the bird's wings over me, the vibrations in the air to my ears. The sun was rising, slinking, though the day was saddled up to go. The desert's lonely nightfall disappears.
And finally, Andy Gilbert, back to you. And your third under-the-radar selection, I love this. It's an album inspired by a Spanish artist from the 18th and 19th centuries. Tell us about it.
Well, Berkeley cellist Teresa Wong is really a rising force in new music. And she wrote this album of short tunes inspired by Goya's etchings, Disasters of War. So there's 21 brief tracks, and it's for violin and cello and two voices. And her partner is Carla Kilstedt, amazing violinist. And I thought we'd listen to Farándula de Charlatanes. And every track takes its name from one of Goya's etchings.
Follow me and share this dance now. Right foot forward, leftward glance now. We claim talking we can resolve. We see talking we can dissolve.
And that's cellist Teresa Wong. And the album is called The Unlearning, is that
right? The Unlearning.
All right. Andrew Gilbert is a San Francisco Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. Steve Hockman, a Los Angeles-based writer who covers pop music. By the way, you'll find Steve and Andy's top 10 list from 2011 at our website, californiareport.org. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks a lot.
And that is the final California Report for 2011, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our directors this week are Nina Thorson and Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is our technical producer, with additional engineering by Howard Gelman and Paul Ancour. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen, with help from David Marks and Katrina Schwartz. Our interns are Rigoberto Hernandez and Rebecca Wolfson. Our producer is Victoria Maleon. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for being with us today. And here's hoping all the best to you and yours in 2012. Happy New Year, everybody.